Basket's looking pretty full tonight. Okay, first one, would you mind sharing some of the difficulties you have had in your practice and how you resolve them? Certainly one of the difficulties was just doubt and uncertainty. That kind of vacillating and wavering kind of mind, not really be able to really settle. So that was a difficulty that I certainly experienced. And a lot of that was just really being patient and learning how to accept the wavering nature of the mind and recognizing that I was generating the doubts and generating the uncertainties, and to be able to see that more clearly. Right? That certainly that plagued me for quite some time. I think the difficulties of living in community, living with other people, having to remember the early days, as a monk, I didn't stay with Ajahn Chah when he first sort of challenged me to stay for 5 years. One of the reasons was if I'd have stayed, I would have had to live with other people. That'd have been really, and particularly other Westerners. That was kind of a fate I couldn't contemplate at that time. So that, having to muster up my own commitment to practicing, and particularly practicing with Ajahn Chah, and then learning how to adapt to other people's personalities, and that again, patience. I mean, that's those are, you know, a lot of the difficulties in practice. It isn't as if there's some, you know, magic wand of the right bit of information or the right insight will finally sort of clear all the difficulties away. It's more being willing to be patient and work with them, be present with them. Okay. Can you talk about karma? Is reaping negative karma from my past actions from the same situation? For example, if I steal, I get stolen from. Or do you reap negative karma from only negative acts I've done in the past? If I get a situation that I've never done, is it from past life actions. There's a there's certain principles that you can assume, but it's not. The Buddha said, you know, if one were to reap the fruits of each action as it were, committed or done, then there would be no way out of suffering. But there's general principles in terms of, yeah, if one has been in conflict in some way with others, then one would tend to result in some sort of conflict. It's not going to be absolutely exactly. It's not a tit-for-tat sort of reprisal. It doesn't work that way. But the patterns sort of follow. One can ameliorate, past actions through one's wholesome actions in this life, and in, you know, past action, but actions from past lives, one can't really know for sure. You can make assumptions, you can make conjectures about it, you can, unless one had sort of the divine knowledge of past lives, you wouldn't really be able to know. And even then, you'd still sort of, it isn't as if it's all, everything is absolutely clear. So then it's, but you can recognize patterns. I mean, in the same way, just that the sense of, I mean, on a very simple level, you know, if you smile and are friendly to somebody, they'll tend to treat you nicely. I mean, it's very simple. It's not that complicated. Or if one is abrupt and short and critical of somebody, you know, they're not going to feel that good about you. So it's a patterns are fairly discernible. So then one can be working to change those patterns. As the Buddha referred to his past lives in measurements of aeons and aeons, is there any information he offered anywhere about the locality of his lives? Were they on planet Earth? This could be useful information for scientists to know the origin of life. Just curious, because he didn't offer thoughts without explaining and justifying them. I think you're getting too peaceful here. I haven't really paid that much attention. My mind doesn't really go to those speculative aspects. And sometimes when the Buddha speaks of his past lives, it's mostly what I can gather. It seems to be something like planet Earth. Although he does talk about other celestial realms, he does specify at times when he has been a celestial being of some sort, and then other than that, most of them have been in the past. But you know, the descriptions are certainly more like planet Earth. But it's definitely not from a. He's not describing the geological aspect, so you can get a sense of what it was like aeons ago. So that I don't think there's any kind of particularly useful information for scientists, other than the fact that when the Buddha speaks of the passing of aeons of time, he does speak of the expansion and contraction of universes, of world systems. How is being the one who knows, as it is suggested, related to anatta? I thought one is not to identify with anything, including the knowing. Thanks again for your teachings. Well, on a certain level, again, it's come back to the practical level of not identifying with anything at all leaves one in a kind of pretty amorphous state. Establishing a foundation of knowing clearly, but also recognizing that the knowing itself arises and passes away. So that doesn't, one can still hold to something without identifying with it or attaching to it. And you hold to it because it bears wholesome fruit. One holds to it because it is a vehicle for liberating the heart. It's a skillful tool that we can rely on. And it's important. If something is skillful and bears fruit, that's the sort of thing you do want to hold to. You want to support that. You want to encourage it. You want to be able to become incredibly familiar with it so that it gains a strength or momentum within the heart. I've been reflecting on the buildup of 30 water bottles outside the hall during each sit, including mine. Really, we're all 30 seconds to 1 minute from our rooms. Will we die of thirst, or have we all become greatly attached to our water bottles? Can you speak about how we find security in such objects, please? Ever since I come to America, I find it a really curious kind of... it's like there's, water bottles and sort of little blankies, maybe. sort of a substitute for blankies. I'm not used to it, is all. I hadn't seen that phenomena before. it is kind of interesting. I'm not quite sure what it is a substitute for. It's supposed to be healthy. I think the point is well taken. Is the following correct? The three characteristics can be seen as verbs. The end of dukkha occurs when the three characteristics are fully understood, so that it is realized that there is no subject or I to whom the object is dukkha-ing. Dukkha in the outside world continues, but one who realizes the truth is not dukkhed by it, because anatta is understood. I hope my questions make sense. But one, I think it's great that you're just reflecting and rolling it over in the mind, and these are these are ways of looking at experience and And that sense of coming to a new perspective or a different perspective or being able to hold it in a slightly different way, I think that's it's really helpful. And there is a certain correctness to it, but I think what is more, correct or beneficial is the sense that one is really reflecting and pondering and in a way that allows one to see these characteristics more clearly. Today, and several times on retreat, I found myself in a heavy mood, feeling torn between equanimity with the experience and using intention to shift my mental state. I sunk further into confusion and depression. This is a pattern for me. Any thoughts are much appreciated. Also related to this, how does volition fit into anatta? Again, I think it's important to be emphasizing with anatta is that and volition is an impermanent phenomena, and then it's also directed towards things which are impermanent, whether it's thoughts or emotion or reflection or stillness, and so that the volition itself, as well as the mental states, they arise and they pass away, so that one can't be holding to any of, identifying with any of this is who I am, this is me, or this is mine. So then, with that use of intention, the use of intention or use of volition, developing the skill in directing our volition toward the things which allow us to relinquish what is unwholesome or conducive to suffering, and then what is conducive to wholesome, skillful states and well-being and clarity, so that we can be directing our attention in those ways. And that we can experience the fruits of that, so that when we get stuck in confusion or depression, then it's finding ways of directing attention which helps to lift the mind or to help to clarify or create a perspective which allows one to have an equanimity or evenness with that, so that one isn't pulled down or sinking with those mental states that are heavy. Is there consciousness, that is, awareness, knowing, in the experience of Nibbana, or is there a complete cessation of all six senses, as some traditions say, particularly in relationship to the experience of stream entry, sotapanna, which is sometimes described as a cessation? Thanks. There's an idiom that comes up in the suttas over and over again, and in reference to the experience of Nibbana, in reference to full liberation, the experience of arahantship, and and which of course would the experience of sotapanna or stream entry would be say prior to that even. So that the idiom is, and the heart was liberated, and they knew it is liberated. So that is very, very clear. There is the experience of liberation, experience of nibbana. There's the knowledge of that. There's the awareness, the knowing of that. Ajahn Chah also, just in terms of not in reference to nibbana, but also in experience of, say, of samadhi, still states of mind, still states of consciousness, when the mind becomes very, very settled. Ajahn Chah would sit there, for it to be in accord with Dhamma, there necessarily needs to be an awareness and knowing of that experience. So that description of cessation as a cessation where there is no knowing whatsoever isn't really a part of the Sutta tradition or a part of the Thai forest masters that I know of. Okay. Mudita, gladness, joy, can be felt by listening to Dhamma, chanting, or uplifting shrine, or beauty no one else can see. I heard the experience of mudita can be a moment or a way of enlightenment. Could you comment, please? Well, certainly the mudita as a always described as a divine abiding, so that these are part of these sublime states of mind where there is this experience of. There's a clarity of mind and stability of mind that comes from this loving kindness, compassion, mudita, and equanimity. They're certainly factors or components of how to establish the mind as one is directing one's efforts to enlightenment on a certain level. There's a there's maybe a certain flavor of the cessation of suffering because they're selfless moments, they're selfless experience, but they're not sort of. How do you say, equated with enlightenment. But the And I think the experience of these divine abidings, as they're refined and cultivated, and experienced in their purity, they are divine abidings, and so that it's an opportunity for that the pressure of that feeling of self is loosened to some extent, so that it's exceedingly uplifting and energizing. Just some thoughts. How do you atone for past unskillful behavior that you know you have done? Will this lower the negative karma you reap? I think one of the things in terms of it's just the recognition of past unskillful karma, past unskillful behavior, and that setting a resolution to refrain from knowing something is unskillful, knowing that it's unwholesome, setting that intention not to do that, that in itself is extremely wholesome and has positive results. One of the ways that the Buddha kind of points to as a way, as a means of alleviating past karma, is through the cultivation of the Brahma-viharas, those divine abodes, that loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, gladness, equanimity. And it's that, as one, say, the power of those, they're beautiful states of being, they have a way of taking over and then sort of like melting the power of whatever unskillful conduct has come from the past, so that and one of the images that the Buddha gives is saying that if one has a a lump of salt or a spoonful of salt, and you put it in a glass of water, then that water is going to be really salty. Whereas if you take the same spoonful of salt and put it in the river Ganges, then it's not going to do that much. It doesn't have that much effect on the river Ganges. So that's in that same discourse that the Buddha talks of the effects of the Brahma-viharas and the effects of loving-kindness, compassion, gladness, equanimity, whatever past action that was unskillful is minimized by the presence of such good action. My mind went to the elements today and how the senses feel them. But can all senses feel all elements? For example, can hearing sense earth? On death, air and fire are gone, but water and earth remain. Is this correct? Are these skillful reflections? They're absolutely skillful reflections. I mean, I think any time when we I mean, it depends how much you obsess, but any time that you reflect on things in a way that has this question our experience tends to be useful. And it's helpful to monitor, okay, what does this do to the mind and how to make it useful and beneficial. So that the generally, when they speak of like the elements, every experience is going to have a mixture of all of the elements, even though sometimes it's very say maybe very small, so that, say, can hearing sense earth? It's more like hearing happens because of the interplay between, say, the earth element of our ear faculty and then the, say, sound waves that come, and then even the sound waves themselves, when you break it down, there's going to be some kind of effect of the, it's nothing's happening in a void, so there is a mixture of all the elements to greater or lesser degree. And then on death, the air element it depends when you say gone, because the breath stops, but then the air element is still present, and if one has ever seen over time a dead body, it starts to swell. So that the air element is still there. Fire, definitely that fire element is decreasing. Water and earth do remain, but then they're also they're going to be dissolving. So that it's all in a state of change and flux, they are going through their process of change. Okay, Venerable, two questions. One, would you kindly review the four ways to respond to questions?
Because I'm only going to be hitting the kind of the bullet points. The categorical answer, kind of analytical answer, counter question, and then disregarding the question. Anybody who's really interested in this topic, Ajahn Jaff has done a really good job of a compilation of how the Buddha responded to questions. He lays it out in a quite an extensive essay, and it's really really quite excellent. I can't remember the name of Skill in Questions. Skill in Questions. And access the Insight website. They've got them all. So he goes into it extensively, and it really is a good essay. And I can't really do it justice. Yeah, we've got it at the monastery as well. When I say essay, I mean it's a beefy essay. okay, the second one. is how can we awaken the feeling or sense of metta within the heart, and would you help me understand the beautiful image of the heart being a vessel filled with loving kindness that you bring people into rather than sending out? Well, you know, that awakening of that sense of metta, one, I think it's helpful to get a sense of what metta is, in that oftentimes, again, this is where you know, there we use the words in English, the older translation, loving kindness, is kind of a hybrid mishmash, trying to get the sense of it, and so that that sense of love or caring is it's not love in terms of a passionate love, but love in terms of a deep sense of caring, and then the kindness aspect is the in that kind of a well-wishing and concern for the well-being of somebody. And of course the first person that we try to pay attention to is the ourselves. How can we care for ourselves? How can we wish ourselves well? How can we look after ourselves? And that's you know, it's an important base to be able to generate, and sometimes even that makes it it's a bit of discomfort sometimes in that, and but I think the coming back to, now, how do I awaken that sense of well-wishing and wanting the well-being and happiness for myself and for others? How do, so that's a, because you start recognizing, well, that's a a fundamental softening of the heart that allows one to empathize and to connect, and connecting with oneself, connecting with others. So you know, this is reflecting in that way, how to. One, that it's something that is desirable and is needed in order to, to live in a way where we can be at ease with the world around us. So that, with that, that fundamental. Well-wishing and care and concern. One starts recognizing that, say, we ourselves and every other being, sentient being, wants to feel good. They want to be happy. You want to be comfortable. They want to be loved and appreciated. I mean, it's not and so learning how to tune into that and to facilitate that, to support it, to nurture it. And then the image of taking the image of the heart as a vessel that one fills with loving kindness. That's something that I think is that I found useful because again the idioms that we use in sort of sending loving kindness there's this busyness that oftentimes takes place and then a losing of the anchor within oneself, so that really being able to find a way where that cultivation of loving kindness has an anchor and a base which one then can build on and extend so that it starts to include and encompass others and all things. Can you please talk a little about merit? A little bit about merit. One, how do you make it? Two, does it have to be intentional? Three, is there a difference in doing a good deed for a monastic versus a layperson in regards to generating merit? Four, can only humans create merit? Or devas, animals? I think merit's an unfortunate translation or term. The word in Pali is punya, and punya refers to that wholesome conduct that bears wholesome results. So that's something fairly straightforward. And there's a discourse where the Buddha said, "Don't be afraid of punya, because punya is the name, is another name for happiness. So that whatever good action, good intention, good speech, that is wholesome, is then it results in well-being and happiness. It's a fundamentally or simply what it is, and it's done through our actions of body, speech, and mind. It doesn't have to be intentional, but I mean, most actions, if they're going to really bear fruit, then that intentional, clear volition is going to bear, say, much greater fruit. Is there a difference in doing a good deed for a monastic versus a layperson in regards to generating merit? Where there's a really big difference is doing a good deed for somebody who is virtuous as opposed to somebody who is not virtuous. That's where the Buddha makes the distinction. Or for somebody who is, say, embodies truth, and that's where sometimes the monastic form gets especially in Asian culture where there's an importance placed on it, but it's more It's more around the virtue and wisdom of the person. So that, and it's not that difficult to, you know, it's not a magical equation. Just when you draw close to somebody who has virtue and wisdom, I mean, you feel good about it. And and when you're doing that, it feels good. When you think about it after, it still feels good. So that's more in terms of that generating of merit. Drawing close to those who embody virtue and wisdom. Can only humans create merit? And devas, animals, both devas. And I guess again, it's just that when that action is done, which is wholesome, then it bears wholesome fruit. It bears meritorious fruit. Animals, a lot more difficult. But it's also where, say animals still make choices of, helping each other or not, and usually those are difficult choices for animals. But when they do, then that is a bears fruit. Okay. When meditating, I have begun to ask myself, "What is the cause of your suffering?" A couple of sense desires arise, namely, the lack of intimacy and lack of a healthy relationship with a partner. My worldview is these desires are normal, but in a Buddhist context, I sense I must let these desires go if I'm to get down the path. I'm left in a quandary and a bit confused. Well, there's a lot of Buddhists out there in relationships with family, and that's I think part of it is having a, in terms of, you're living in the world, they are normal. But they still need to have boundaries. And they also have to have in terms of suffering, so much of our, the desires are trying to satisfy a feeling of kind of lack within ourselves, and that's where just that cultivation of loving kindness and compassion. Cultivation of virtue and generosity. These are wholesome qualities that allow us to feel a sense of fullness. And then if one has intimacy or relationships, they're a lot more wholesome then. They're a lot more they have a basis one isn't dependent on the relationship for one's well-being. One's well-being is there, and then you do what you do in the world. That's my take, anyway. Okay, one practice is to cultivate joy, happiness, energy, peaceful mind. Comes with and from happiness. But if these things are the defilements of insight into the three characteristics, then I feel left with nothing, kind of despair, feeling empty, but not in a good way, more at a loss. Well, the thing is I didn't say every state of joy and happiness, energy and peaceful mind was a defilement of insight. It can be a basis for the. It's where we have our the attachment can arise. The tools that the Buddha points out as the foundations of practice rely on those wholesome mental states, and that's sort of said over and over several times during the retreat. How much when something is in accord with Dhamma, wholesome mental states arise, unwholesome mental states diminish, and so that wholesome mental state of, say, having joy that arises, unwholesome mental states diminish. If an attachment to that joy or that assumption of, man, I'm just the best meditator ever, arises dependent on that, and that's an unwholesome mental state, and that's been a cause for that's going to create suffering. So that learning how the place of these mental states, how to cultivate them, how to support them, and then also to discern what are how they facilitate one's continued growth in the practice. Can you talk about path and fruit in regards to the stages of awakening? What are they? How are they different? One of the ways of speaking about sort of path and fruit is, of course, the path is the cultivation of the practice, and the kind of stages of clarity and insight that arise, and it's usually in relationship to particular patterns of attachments and defilements that within the mind, and how we can see those clearly and relinquish them. The first they're called fetters, and the first fetters, the things that bind us, are the identification, identifying with body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, as this is me, this is who I am, this is mine, that on the entering of the stream, that falls away. And then there's two others that fall away at the same time, and that's an assumption of that there's these particular practice and precept that one has to do in order to have purity. Just by doing it, one's purity comes from that, and then having doubt skeptical doubt about the path, about the practice, about the teachings. So then those fall away. When there's a certainty and clarity that arises to that degree. And the next stage is what's called a once returner, and means that there's an attenuation of sense desire and ill will. And then with the third stage, there's a relinquishing of sense desire and ill will. It doesn't form a part of one's habits of mind at that point. Then the last stage, that comprised the arahant, is around the aspects of more subtle aspects of restlessness, ignorance, and sort of the subtle forms of self-view. Could you please talk a bit more about the three types of liberation, signless, desireless, not self? Especially the third one. Is it a liberation in the sense of being free from suffering? As the liberation is that signless liberation, desireless liberation, emptiness liberation. So that there's a perception of emptiness. It depends on its because there's both in all of these. Say there's a samadhi or state of concentration that is based on these, and then there's a liberation of mind through that doorway. So that doorway is the one that works for one, or is the trigger for one, and that is in that there is a freedom from suffering. May I ask what was done with the ashes/bones of the monk cremated in Thailand? I was wondering, Ajahn Chah. I think that's the only one I really talked about, wasn't it? It's actually quite interesting. Because one of the things that we, when we were organizing Ajahn Chah's cremation, saw a few of the different great forest monks and whatnot, and then thinking about it. Anyway, we decided that we weren't going to distribute Ajahn Chah's bones, ashes. Well, actually, some of the ashes we distributed, but the actual bones were kept, and they were put into a large jetty, and that's a shrine that people go to. Pay respects to. A portion of those bones are inside the jetty and on display, so you can sort of see them. They're a bit high, so it's a bit difficult to see really clearly. Oftentimes what happens with some of these great teachers is that the ashes or bone will kind of transform into some kind of crystal or some kind of something quite different. It doesn't look like bone anymore. I think one of the really Ajahn Mun's are very, very clear. And then you could see the the actual transition, like with the bone transforming into clear crystal, and they're on display. One of his senior disciples, Lumpu Khao, his are really interesting because they're like, they're like amethyst, like a clear purple, very beautiful. I was given one of those. Those are offered to Abhayagiri, and we actually it's up behind the Buddha Rupa in the back. It's in, we've got to put that in the back. And Ajahn Chah, as he usually did, his are different, and his are kind of large, and almost like coral or something. So they're mostly white, but they're sort of white and brown and black. And turned into these large sort of coral formations. That's kind of interesting. Would you be willing to tell us a little bit about the first steps that led you out of northern Manitoba towards becoming an abbot in Thailand? Got a lot of suffering. Suffering, dissatisfaction. Pain, grief, and despair. It's northern Manitoba. It's, you got to get out of it. There. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it was interesting, like meeting up with. I've had contact with. Some of my friends who we grew up with, and after, because I didn't go back to North America until I'd been a monk for about 16 years or so. So that was my first visit back, and then meeting up with old friends they all sort of said, oh, I knew you were going to do something. You know, it's just okay, dear General Pisano, thank you for your talk today. Could you please expand further on how to maintain / practice tranquility in everyday life, especially as we, quote-unquote, pick up any of the things in our lives. And then P.S., could you please tell us the translation of Lumpo? Is this the right spelling? And also if it is appropriate for laity to address you by this term. It's just... what it literally means is sort of... which might not make sense in English, but it means sort of venerable father, and what it means is I'm getting old. it's a term in Thai. It's a term of respect and affection. There's a warmth there that it's not a. I mean, you've seen maybe the monastics and Debbie using it, but it's because they're familiar with it. And it's just the aging process continues, and then it's people have started calling me that. And that maintaining of that and practicing tranquility in everyday life. I think one of the things that's really important in terms of maintaining and practicing tranquility is really looking after right view. In terms of really attending to that sense of having our view, our perspectives, our considerations informed by Dhamma, informed by a view that accords with Dhamma, and then you'll find that you've got an anchor to return to, just those recollections of impermanence, the recollections of the anicca, dukkha, anatta. Those are so that trying to reflect in ways that returns one to right view. Ajahn Chah used to put tremendous amount of effort into, of course, teaching, but once we you look at the spectrum of his teachings, and the vast majority of it would be around sila and samadhiti, virtue and right view, because those are really the tools that give an anchor for, say, tranquility, for an equanimity, or if not equanimity, at least an equable kind of basis to be receiving the world around us and engaging in the world. So those ways that we can be strengthening virtue and right view, right? These are really, really important. And then the different techniques and tools that one picks up for maintaining a base of mindfulness and tranquility, those are things that you pick up as you find useful. Like for myself, one of the things that I've always relied on is the mindfulness of the body, really coming back to the body. Okay. One of the questions last night talked about the breath becoming rapid when not controlled. I was confused. Am I right that we are not supposed to control our breath? Anapanasati is not like pranayama or breathing exercise. Please clarify. Yeah, in general, one is not. You're not trying to control the breath. You're not trying to. You're just recognizing what is actually happening, so that it isn't a breathing exercise in that sense. It's just one is tuning in and recognizing what is the rhythm of the breath. Is it long? Is it short? But you aren't making it long, making it short. Although sometimes, there are times when one, take a breath and slow down a bit here. Breathe deep here because it's a useful tool at that moment, but you're not, it's not a strategy to control the breath. It's just that using mindfulness, it does tend to settle. Okay. Seems like the more I quote unquote see clearly, the more depressed I feel rather than freedom. Nothing seems to be of interest or worth bothering with. The level of depression borderlines on suicidal sometimes, which concerns me. When I feel this way, I can't seem to meditate to help situations. I get frozen. Any practice suggestions? One of the things that's important in terms of seeing clearly is also, we have to pay attention to the lens with which we're seeing clearly with. Because sometimes we see clearly, but then we focus on that which takes us into negativity or aversion or annihilation, and that's always the, say, from the Buddhist perspective, it's all associated with, say, vipava tanha, the desire for not being, not wanting, and pushing away, and that takes one into dark places of depression or nihilism, that's where fundamental base lines of virtue and good action and feeling good about it is important. Generosity and kindness and connecting with other people in wholesome ways. It's really important. The perception that somehow one can meditate oneself into enlightenment without having to feel good about oneself or feel good about the world around one. And I don't think that's helpful. I think these fundamental ways of establishing like Dana Barami, Sila Barami, these are ways that allow a human being to feel good about being human. Reflections on, say, aspects of the reflections on refuge, having refuge in something that uplifts the mind, that uplifts the heart, that allows the heart to take delight. When the Buddha talks about his first kind of injunction to the first 60 monks who realized liberation, and then he said, go out in all, no person should go together with each other, go out in all different directions. Go out for the welfare and the happiness of all beings. And that's it. That sense of this is what it's about is establishing some kind of a connection with what is wholesome, what is skillful, which brings welfare and happiness to ourselves and others. These are fundamental perspectives, and we can get sometimes caught into over critical, over negative perceptions of ourselves and the world, and it's important to recognize that that's an increase in unwholesome dhammas and a decrease of wholesome, and to be able to find ways to draw close to what is actually going to be for the arising of what is wholesome, is good, is brightening to the mind. Okay, after 20 plus years of having a daily practice and the Dharma being first priority, I just up and stopped meditating one day about 2 years ago. The teacher told me it was called rolling up the mat, quote unquote. I'd never heard this term. Can you talk about this? why it happens, how and when, etc. I'm currently working on unrolling the mat, quote unquote. I actually haven't heard this term. I think we can, we can only run on, idealism and duty for so long. And so if we feel that meditating and practicing is just some kind of duty or chore that we're doing, that we've been functioning on some kind of unrealistic expectations, torture ourselves with unrealistic expectations, then we can run out of steam. This is where reflecting in different ways, hearing teachings from different teachers or doing something that shakes it up somehow and gets us to both to reflect on ourselves and reflect on the purpose of the path, the purpose of the teachings, because if it's just a slogging away because one feels one should, that's not very sustainable. There's any number of ways that we can undermine ourselves, and it's important to understand that and to reflect on it. But that, that basic reflection of what accords with Dhamma is what increases the wholesome in terms of increasing well-being, happiness, clarity, and decreases the unwholesome, whether it's negativity, aversion, confusion. For it to be functioning, how is that working? And to say, how do we make it work? Is it working within us? If it isn't, well, how do we adjust? How do we change? Who do we draw close to? That sense of drawing close to good spiritual friendship. That's really important. Because sometimes we get, we get locked into our own either misconceptions or application of the practice, and it gets really dreary. So if it gets dreary for too long, you just give up on it. Two questions. Why would consciousness not be considered self? Because it arises and passes away. Because in the English language, sometimes there is that conception that somehow consciousness is this stable, permanent thing. Buddhist concept of it is consciousness is the function of the awareness or knowing of a sense object. It arises, it passes away. So that consciousness is in not being stable consistently arising and ceasing. It's not really, like the Buddha said one time, you'd be better off thinking the body was self, because at least the body lasts for 10, 20, 50, even as 100 years. But the mind is rising and ceasing faster than you can even keep up with. And then what is the 10,000-fold universal system mentioned in the discourse setting the wheel in motion? That's the whole cosmology of the Buddhist conception of things. And at that, there are many layers of realms of a being, realms of existence. And that was Member Ajahn Sujito's book, The Dawn of the Dhamma, where he gives explanation and illustrations of the discourse on setting the wheel of Dhamma in motion, and that the chapter which is that starts with this and the 10,000-fold universal system. Shake and quake, and anyway, the chapter heading was a whole lot of shaking going on. Okay, there's a lot of questions tonight, so we'll have a bit of a break.